EMS Garage is brought to you by EMS Manager, www.emsmanager.net.
You can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone there. Wanted to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Paramedic 22 is on scene.
I have to admit, though, the only special team I've really been a part of was when Bledsoe started. Actually, the critical care team. He started at in Dallas. And that I wanted to bring it up, but I didn't want to stir the pot too much because he kept on talking about, is there any research to this? Is there anything? It's like, I don't think there was any research on what you started in Dallas.
I call that the last refuge of the scoundrel.
Because really, we started a dual paramedic, no nurses, transport helicopter service. And we did it for Columbia Hospitals, which had come in, if you remember Columbia, those shysters. They came in and overnight bought about half of Dallas up, and they wanted us to be their primary transport agency. And our helicopter was even named Columbia One. And when we started that, we scoured the country trying to find out if anybody had ever done that before. And the closest we could get to it, and now we may have just overlooked somebody, so somebody else had heard of something like that, let me know. But the closest we could come to it was a service in Wyoming that was their primary response vehicle. Actually, an EMT who was also a helicopter pilot drove a paramedic in the back of a helicopter that responded to some remote stuff. But every other program we looked at had nurses on it and things like that. And we kept asking, you know, are we going to get nurse ringers? Are we going to get this? Are we going to get that? And who's ever started a program that's just for transport that does this and things like that? And so I was kind of wanting to throw that out there, but it was kind of funny. He seems to have something against bike medics, though, I guess. I'm not sure what that is about.
Well, I'm here to tell you, anybody who thinks you need to have evidence to give people more training in some particular area of what they do has just lost it.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I brought up real early is, like, how do you – I mean, I know you can kind of do postmortem studies on the effectiveness of a program, but I mean, how would you try and design a study to see if you needed a bike program? I don't even know how you design such a thing. You pretty much just have to go, do we need that? Yeah, let's give it a shot. If it doesn't work, we'll stop. You know,
I think there's some other factors here. I mean, we're a medical service and we treat people medically, but does that not mean that we are not also responsible for some public relations and also some retention efforts? And so, like you said, if we can get somebody some more training, if we can give them something that makes them want to stick around because they're a member of a bike team, if the public says, hey, look, that's a bicycle medic, because they see you out in the public. You're not just this, you know, torso in an ambulance, you know, that drives by. You're this physical person that's present during public events. It is, you know, there are other factors rather than the simple patient care factors that we have to deal with.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
We'll start the podcast and we'll carry on.
I can do it all again.
I know you anyway. You're already recording, probably.
That's why I wasn't worried about it, Chris.
No, we didn't miss anything.
Speaking of scoundrels.
Here I am. Scoundrel number one and public enemy number one. Wow.
Jerry, did you get around as much as George Washington did?
Do I what?
Get around as much as old George did?
I think I probably do. No, and I didn't chop down a cherry tree either.
Well, actually, I'm not gonna take that moniker because John Bignell started EMS Live way before I did. I'm the second podcast to hit the scene, but I'm the longest running currently running podcast, so I guess that works. Over at Medicast. I actually do. I touch base with him quite a bit, and he's a nice guy. You know, he's in mortician school right now. He got fed up with, you know, dealing with EMS pay cuts in Canada and dealing with the issues up there. And a friend of his who worked at the local mortuary, you know, contacted him and offered him a job there with free training and like half again as much money and daytime hours. Yeah, and he's got a new baby, and so it was just a lot. It was an easy decision for him to make, even though he misses it. But we keep in touch. I'll get him your information. Well, he you can still find a lot of good stuff over his site, emslive.com. I write some articles over there. A lot of other great EMS providers do. So you should, you know, everybody listening should go over and check that out. He's always looking for more authors. So if you got something you're passionate about, anybody out there, you can go ahead and ask to submit something, and he'll get you signed in. You can submit articles.
Yes, yes. But I will. I've got it turned down now. I won't blast you if it happens. Well, let's try not to. I'd like to hang around. No more.
Hey, how you doing, Chris? Hi, thank you.
Bring her on.
I'm on Irish whiskey, so we'll do good.
So I can't believe people think that they can be too loopy to be on this show.
Really? Absolutely.
Awesome.
Cool. Hey, but I got a question. I want to ask the listeners this. You said that you get about 25,000 uniques to each site. Yet only about 6,000 people are downloading the garage. Is that correct? Oh, but that's a month. So if you time 6,000 by 4, you get 20. Ah, never mind. Not me being stupid.
I think that was Buck being loopy.
It is.
I heard you had a really great. I heard you had a really great podcast last week, Buck. On the edge.
Yeah. There was this guy. I can't remember his name. Oh, you should. It was really good, and it was an education for everybody involved. Now, I'm actually kind of excited about the program. Now I want to know more about it. So I've been reading some of these documents you turned me on to, and everything. It was good. Yes, yeah, so, instant plug, EMS Educast, all you people who want to know about community paramedicine. We talked to Gary Wingrove and a couple other people that were involved with the program for a whole hour. So if you've ever wondered about that, or if you live in a rural district and thought that maybe you'd like to kind of change the way things are done and treat people in their homes for more than just calling 911, give us a listen. Is that up yet, Chris, or is... Oh, okay. I'm out of it. I've been out of town for all weekend. I just got back in and started working way too much. I took my little daughter to this place in Santa Claus, Indiana, called Holiday World. And it's just a place. It's an amusement park that's family owned. It's very nice, very clean, and some place for little kids her age to completely lose their little minds. And she had a good time. So I know. They keep it all year round there. No. The giant frying pan is even nearer than the giant ball of string. So, yeah.
Hello. Oh God, this could end really, really badly. I have the cyclobenzaprine, which is loads of fun already, and then the Vicodin, which is also loads of fun. So, and I have my first day of work tomorrow, so this is going to end well. I tried to explain that to my parents, and they didn't understand or believe me. Excellent.
I get some bold email about it. In fact, one guy said that he ruined, and I think Gary Wingrove's blocked or something. Hello, Gary.
Oh, yeah, I just went to my basement. So.
Nice.
Oh, that's an objective for any good humor is whether you can cause coffee to come out through the nose.
Oh, it's okay. We're good either one.
So how do you know that you left the Ouch. Yeah. Well, Skip, you were passionate about it. What you got going, man? Oh. He was so angry he fell over and broke another chair and decided to answer. He's ringing. Are you back, Skip? Ah.
Back.
Yeah, my Dutch Scud came from Alaska.
Oh no, we were trying to start off the discussion. I said, well, Skip had most to say during the email volley. So I was gonna ask him what he thinks about the special teams. And first of all, I wanna start off with a compliment. I am from Texas, I was just north of Travis County, and those guys are top notch. If anybody should be allowed to be playing with large toys like that, it should be Travis County. Those are top notch guys, have all the respect for them in the world.
Well, I do. Well, we have some special teams, but you know, it's just to let everybody know where we started from. Dr. Bledsoe's challenge was the basic evidence-based fetish that, well, there's no evidence that any of those teams do any good. To which my response was something irreverent like, "So what?" But most of our volleys back and forth were whether you actually should have to have evidence to show that something non-clinical that you want to do is a good thing to do or not. I'm more of the mind that, you know, first of all, that, you know, there's never been a prospective randomized controlled trial of the efficacy of a parachute.
His kids are watching Hulu. Well, don't send people other places.
Well, I'll pick up the ball for skipping you back, because otherwise I'll pick up the ball. All right, well, I'm just going to jump in and are you back or are you not? All right, we need a special EMS internet team to rescue Skip from Skype.
Well, can you hear me now? Okay.
We can't rescue him, of course. We don't have any medical, we don't have any results or surveys or research to say that it's effective to rescue Skip. So we're not going to put that team together.
Yeah, really. Can you hear me now?
No.
Well, I think that the thing that the argument that Brian made is he missed some things. Okay, if there is no medical evidence and we are supposed to be doing medical-based treatments.
Yeah. Who keeps cutting me off?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think Brian's trying to say that, you know, we need to have more medical, more research-based medicine and treatment. And I certainly agree with that when it comes to treatments. But I think that there's a different aspect to specialty teams that doesn't just focus on the treatment. And some of the things we do are not just because they have a medical effect. They could have an effect on recruiting, retention of staff. They could have an effect on public relations and visibility of the service and education of the public about what we do. You know, there are a lot of other aspects to specialty service teams. And I think that never really came up in the arguments. And I think that there's a difference between whether or not we should be you know, using ET tubes as much as paramedics do in the field, when there may or may not be evidence to the effect that that is not as effective. That is a medical treatment that needs to have research around it. There, bike teams or Segway medic teams or, you know, hazmat teams, that is a completely different picture, and there are a lot of other aspects to that than just the medical treatment.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Oh, you know, I gotta tell you, 2 years ago at EMS Today, I was cruising around on the Segway, and that's as much fun as you can have with your clothes on.
Oh man,
I promise.
I'm getting a really weird vision.
They
are a blast.
Well, I'll refer everybody to Weird Al's White and Nerdy video where he's cruising on his.
Yeah. But Jamie, you made the point that I was trying to make much more coherently than I could. And that was that some things just are not, evidence is not necessary. You do them because they're good for something, they're fun for something, and whether they ever see a patient or not, they have merits.
Mm. Or sometimes we do it because our customers demand it.
Well, our customer, absolutely. Or we do it because it's a way to maintain system integrity. And let me explain what I mean by that. At least in my county and several other places where I've been, the cops want to have paramedics with them when they go do dangerous stuff. We are the paramedics. So there are two choices. Either we provide them the service, or they go and create some paramedics of their own who will not be as experienced, as integrated in with the system, and all of that. So just purely to maintain the integrity of the system and unity of command and all of that stuff, sometimes you just got to provide the service. But I submit that all the things that that Jamie named, recruiting and retention and morale and all of that stuff, mean that, you know, if for just a little bit of money you can provide medics with a few days a year of some alternative to the front of the truck or the back of the truck, you're doing something that's good for your organization and probably good for the business in general.
Mm. There's something I wanted. Well, one of the things I mentioned in the email volley that kind of got glossed over because of all the claws and fighting that I saw was that every once in a while something new comes up, and there isn't a study about it, and you just have to do it. I've worked on the fire side before, and forgive me if some of my emails were kind of rough, but I keep forgetting, you know, something bad about the place where I work. There are a lot of people where I work in the area, the general area, not all of them, but a lot of people who are on special teams around here are the exact kind of people you don't want on special teams, I have to say. And so that's kind of colored my judgment. Yeah.
There.
Well, no, it's one of these self-fulfilling prophecies. Most of the people that I see that get on these specialty teams would probably, if I was the leader of the specialty team and I'm not, everybody who applied would instantly be, like, thrown off the list. And then I would recruit people who don't want to be on the specialty team. But I know, it's just, and I'm sure that there are many wonderful people out there who do it, but I've seen so many people that just, it gets kind of ridiculous after a while. But back to what I was talking to before. One of the big things that came up around here in the last few years is tower rescue. Now, I don't know if you guys have known this. It's kind of a subset of high angle rescue where there are so many cell phone towers going up, and these things, I don't know if you've seen them, these things are kind of ridiculous, but they go, sorry, they go straight up in the air, and they usually only have guide wires on them. And there's a lot of technicians putting up a lot of cell phone stuff, a lot of different things. And every once in a while, it's not very often, but one of these guys has a medical emergency. It starts hanging up there. And it's different than the usual high-angle stuff. And most of these things are too tall for an aerial ladder to get up there. And nobody had a study for this. They just asked people who were high-angle rescue guys, and they said, you know what? I bet you could do it like this, and let's come up with this. And they started looking at products, and before you know it, a guy had written a book, and they did this. But I guarantee there aren't enough instances in the country of this happening for somebody to actually have done some sort of evidence-based study. But the truth is, you have to provide the service because it's a possible thing that happens in your area. So you give it a shot. And I'm sure there will be postmortems on how things went for years, and we'll learn more about it. But after a while, you just got to get some people who are experts in things that are near it and come up with something, much like Gary Wingrove went to all the experts to make a community paramedic program. So that's one of the things I was thinking about it. You can't do a study about some stuff. Some stuff is just you knew you got to do it. The technology has allowed you to do it. And you just got to jump out there and give it a try every once in a while.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I've got a maybe a little more conservative approach, but maybe not. The question of who does the rescue. I think that horse left the barn 20 years ago, and EMS unfortunately left rescue and let that go to the fire service. That's done. But there are medical needs that operate in the environment of all of these special teams that need to be taken care of by somebody. At hazardous materials incidents, you got two sets of people need taken care of. One is citizens, the public, patients who get contaminated by hazardous materials. They need to be decontaminated. They need to be cared for by people who know what they're doing. There's also, and this is the important part that I think that gets overlooked, the medical support of the hazardous materials team itself. The medical monitoring and the caring for them when they, before they put on their suits, after they come out of their suits, the rehab. That is stuff that paramedics ought to be doing. So for each of our teams we support a group of law enforcement tactical teams. We support a regional hazardous materials team. We support a regional USART team. And for each of those teams, we have a group of 15 medics and a supervisor, up to 15 medics and a supervisor. We'd never quite get to full strength, who are trained to both take care of the citizens sort of inside the warm zone or the hot zone or whatever you want to call it, and to take care of the members of those teams with their unique job demands that not everybody else has. And I think that's inherently an EMS function. And again, if we're going to be the paramedics, we need to provide it.
I haven't chimed in because I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that I honestly have no idea. I just kind of do my job, and I've never had to deal with something as far as this goes. So I'm just kind of listening because I feel like I don't have anything to add to the conversation. My apologies, gentlemen.
But we're glad to hear from you anyway.
Well, thank you.
You've been doing a lot of fire training lately, though, haven't you?
I was in the fire academy for a little while, which was really fun, and I didn't actually get to make it to like any of the good stuff.
Oh. All right. Well, Gary, come on, you, Mr. Conference Man, you've got to have some insight into this.
Well, we support.
Go ahead.
We support the resources that are necessary in the various places where we operate. We're part of that team, and we know that we have to support the other parts of the public safety team that need us to be there. So we do.
And we've had, I've had some experience working with some of the tactical teams. The state police in Maryland primarily responds to our area with their tactical team that includes a cross-trained trooper paramedic. And they also bring a cross-trained trauma doc from the trauma center in Baltimore. And they come out to any barricade situations. I've been on several of those as the transport unit. And, you know, I think that Buck's right when he says that there's an interagency, there's an interagency aspect to this that, you know, that transcends that medical research need. And I also think that, you know, if it does get bad, you know, when bullets start flying, there are multiple opportunities for major injuries and multi-system trauma, and not just one patient. And so when you have an opportunity to have a person with a little more directed and specific training, when you have an opportunity to have someone else there, like a trained trauma physician, you know, more power to them if that's what they want to do. And I think that we need to support that. We also have a county hazmat unit that when it was planned and put into place a couple of years back, when we stopped borrowing one from the neighboring county, we had an opportunity to build it from the ground up. And part of that was to include both EMTB trained personnel and paramedic and ALS trained personnel in that mix, that also had to have at least hazmat technician training, because they needed to be cross-trained. They needed to understand the inherent dangers of what's going on in a given situation, or at least have a better handle on knowing how to look up what the possible hazards are. And that, you know, there should be no reason for your average transport unit with their, you know, quarter of a chapter of their EMS text when they were in school, and some refresher training and hazmat awareness training that they are required to have, they should not be going into the orange zone, or whatever you want to call it. They should be back where it's safe and clean, and let somebody else handle the treatment that is able to understand the necessities of how to decontaminate and everything else. And I think that, you know, that's, you need that specialized training. You need a cross-trained specific individual to do that job.
Let me
But I guess I can't. I'm trying to find some kind of connection between that and having specialty trained medics who might have prevented the very phone call that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, before you, I mean, unless you've been through a course of instruction to find out what these guys are trained to do. I suggest that there are legitimate and valid services that I learned to provide when I went to tactical medical school many years ago that you just can't envision if you haven't gone through a course to learn it.
You know, well, tell us about it, because I have the same kind of – I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you while you're about to do that very thing. Sorry.
Go ahead. You know, for example, one of the things you learn to do in tactical medic school is they call it medicine across the barricade. You know, envision somebody who has gone in and taken a store or a school or something hostage, and they've got this guy. Now they're not negotiating over the throw phone that the tactical negotiators use. And he says, yeah, well, I'm not going to come out and get my pizza that you put the drugs in because I got somebody in here who's bleeding. And what the medics have learned is kind of like a cross between EMD and I don't know, making it up as you go along, but how to interact with the person on the other end of the phone and coach somebody through doing medical procedures in the distance. You know, could somebody make that up as they went along? Sure. But if you've got somebody who's been to tactical medic school, they've been trained in how to do it by somebody who has a curriculum and a syllabus and a certification and what have you. And that's just one example. You don't learn much in the way of new medicine. You know, again, I went through 15 years ago, and, you know, at that time, things like new trachs and quick trachs were brand new, and that was the airway station. But you do learn some stuff about employing the tools that you have already available to you in new and different manners. You know, can you intubate somebody without, you know, exposing yourself greater than 3 feet above the ground? Sure. If you learn how, somebody teaches you. So what you really in all of these programs, there's really two components. There's some additional professional knowledge that you need to interact with the team and the environment that you're going to support. And there's some new ways of applying existing professional knowledge and skills that you might not have thought of if you hadn't spent some time getting some training.
Well,
to address, you know, I mean, it sounds like both of you have had some experience with highly unprofessional, unorganized. It sounds like even independent, so-called special teams, and you know, the heart of being qualified for a special team is to be a good performing paramedic in the existing legitimate EMS organization. And where the ones that scare me are, you know, Billy and Bob get together and form Billy and Bob's tactical medic squad and get some sheriff to you know, take them on. That should be the responsibility of the local EMS agency, which should be run by competent professionals who will weed out the Yahoos and Billy Bobs before they ever get to the training.
Well, I do have a serious question. I want to put it on you since you're speaking for this and seems to have some experience with it. A minute ago, you said that it would be inappropriate for a cop to send somebody to paramedic school and rely on that person to be, because that wouldn't be an experienced paramedic. And actually, I've seen that done. There were a couple of places in Texas that did this.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, and you know, they were lucky, and I don't think any major incidents happened, so you know, nothing bad came from it. But let's turn that around a little bit. Let's turn that around and say, okay, you're taking a paramedic and making them part of an entry team. Okay, now this person is not an experienced cop by any stretch of the imagination. Also, the MD that may be going in is not an experienced cop by any stretch of the imagination. And is that person, with their lack of knowledge on the cop side, a liability to the cops as they make entry? And are they there for something that hardly ever happens? And my question is that liability heavier on the scale than that service that you hardly ever utilized? I guess is my question.
Well, you know, I think you start out with an assumption that the service is hardly ever utilized.
Okay, I may be wrong about that.
There was a heck of a database maintained by the Casualty Care Research Center until it got reorganized after September 11th. And I don't really know where it wound up, but they had been collecting data on sort of the epidemiology of injury during tactical operations for a good 15 years. And there's some pretty impressive stuff in there. But to answer your question, you know, I think you got to rely on the professionalism on the other side to make sure that one of several things happens. Either the people get the appropriate training, or that the operation is framed around whatever their level of capability is. You know, there's always the big discussion about, you know, whether you take your paramedic and train him to be a cop and commission him so he can carry a firearm or not, or whether you have him be a non-law enforcement paramedic and dedicate a tactical officer to protecting the paramedic who's inside the perimeter. But, you know, my guys, for example, aren't part of the entry team. We support 300 to 400 law enforcement tactical operations per year for about the last 4 years now, and they don't go through the door. You know, they stage right out, you know, outside the front porch behind some sort of very firm barricade, where you know the cops do their thing and their medic is nice and close to them.
That makes sense too.
Yeah, and I'll jump in here too. One of the situations in which I was involved as a transport unit, we had a situation where one of the police officers that was involved in entering the building, somehow the tear gas canister he was preparing to fire from the approach vehicle, they have like this SUV tank thing that they use, drove up. He popped the hatch, stood up in the hatch, and somehow the tear gas canister went off and he wasn't clear of the hatch yet. So it launched into the vehicle and deployed.
Oops.
Yeah. And so, you know, so we talk about treating the people, you know, in a hazmat situation that are in the hazmat team, the rehab that's involved there. Well, we had a situation where we had an exposure to one of our own, you know, people that was not a bullet wound or anything else. Other than knowing my basic treatment of a person who's been exposed to something like that, and we flush and we flush and we flush, I didn't know anything about the what kind of substance it was, what long-term effects there were. You know, I was tearing up just standing next to the guy. So, you know, was there a hazard to me? Luckily, we had a member of the tactical team who was a paramedic and a physician there who had trained with this substance and knew all about it and were able to answer the questions and take care of this individual. They just needed to get the supplies off my unit to do so. And I think that that's just an indication of how often does that happen? Probably not very often, but luckily, they had the experience and the knowledge to take care of it if it did happen. And that's, you know, a kind of humorous story of an injury that was not serious, but certainly an indication of what's going on.
Humorous to everybody but those who were there.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, it was humorous to everybody but the guy that was inside driving. Everybody else had, I mean, every member of that team came in and stuck their head in the back of the unit and got a big grin on their face and said, "You'll be all right," and kept walking. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, you know, I think maybe Chris and I have been colored by the, by the experience we've had with people in our areas who are chosen to do special teams or just make their own. And I'm not saying I have yet to see a professional one. I'm not saying that at all. Oh my God, I'm going to get so much hate mail. Yeah, I know. There are good guys. There are good guys. And I have respect though. Well, you know, I don't want to even say that. You know, I don't want to even say that because one of the most respected teams around here is a severely rural team. And Kentucky's full of it. Oh, my God. Not full of it. We've got so much stuff. We've got cave rescue here. We've got high angle. We've got low angle. We've got hazmat. And one of the services I ran for one time, and now this wasn't rural, okay, this was in the Louisville area, but in the ring around Louisville, there was this county, unincorporated county, that had so many townships, and they actually had 20 different fire departments in various stages of volunteer slash paid. And none of them at the time were organized enough to run really hazmat operations. So in here, Jefferson County EMS stepped up to the plate, and they ran hazmat operations for the whole county, which at the time when they ended it, because they merged with the city EMS department, they ran over 600,000 people they covered. And they did several things. They did trench rescue, they did hazmat, confined space, all that kind of stuff, and they did it well. And there were various people, and every once in a while, people on those teams were nut bars, like I was talking about. But I don't know, and everything's just topsy-turvy now, and everybody's just trying to vie for power and everything like that, and I don't know what I think about it now. But I know that some of the teams I have had response to, there was one in Texas that was just, oh, man, I wouldn't let them rescue my cat out of a tree. But yeah, I mean, and I wish, now here's a good question. Who validates these teams? Is there some national entity who comes and audits the inner workings of different teams that call themselves a confined space rescue team? That's what I'd like to know, because I've seen kinda, so much weird stuff.
It kind of depends on who you're talking about. You know, there's a fairly complex accreditation scheme for law enforcement, so I won't even go there. But the other two teams that we support are the regional hazardous materials team and the regional urban search and rescue teams, and they are commissioned, funded, and overseen by the Office of the State Fire Marshal and the State Emergency Management Agency, a sort of joint venture. They put up all the money for it and set the training standards and what have you. But there are, you know, there are competency standards for the technicians at the various levels.
I'm wondering if this isn't something that maybe, you know, because OSHA has a little bit of say in how these teams are put together, especially the ones that wind up doing industrial things like confined space and hazmat and whatnot. I keep thinking maybe they should write like a paper, white paper, or a direction for how, you know, most of these teams should go, and have, and they would have the teeth to actually find them if they misbehaved, it seems like.
But say, the standards typically come, you know, rarely does OSHA make up its own standards. They usually adopt something somebody else has been done. And you see that the technical competency standards are NFPA standards.
Another finger in the pie.
Yeah, and then, you know, they set the standards, and, you know, and OSHA enforces where there's a problem. You know, I know, for example, we had not long ago, we had a group of workers trapped in a trench collapse, and there was one fatality. And, you know, as the regional resources mustered to
Are you there?
Can you hear me? Hello? Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, as the regional resources were gathering, you know, the local OSHA guys showed up, and they were also a presence.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. This is something I've always wondered about. Now, the OSHA guys were there to crawl in the stuff of the employer who made the dangerous situation, why you got called in the first place, right?
Well, yes and.
And the and
was that they stood there and monitored the conduct of the rescue and recovery operations to make sure that the people who were doing that followed all the applicable standards.
Okay, that's cool too, because that, you know, and I could be speaking out of my butt, and somebody probably correct me, but it seems like, you know, the other part of that is there are employees too who are trying to rescue those folks, and they have a whole set of guidelines to work around too. And just in a couple of the small scenes that I've been a part, and some of the larger ones, it seems like when OSHA does make a presence, they're they seem to be worried about investigation, what's going on, instead of all the employees who are trying to rescue the folks, which can be dangerous as well. So that's just one of the things on my mind. I was looking for some sort of national organization that has the power to find folks and make people behave, because I've seen people that need to be made to behave. But there is.
I don't. I've just been Googling as you've been talking.
You know what was the evil thing in Texas, though? I got to tell you this. They had a tactical medic program that was at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and it was very respected. I think it was about 2 weeks long. They've since shut it down. I don't think they do it anymore. But Texas was so enamored with this certification that they came out with a new paramedic patch for it. I don't know if you get – yeah, well, yes, it's the black patch. You were a ninja paramedic afterwards. And so everybody wanted to take that. I swear to God, everybody wanted to take that course just to get the freaking black patch.
Oh, and I'd do it. I'd do it.
Right. Right. Yeah. But that's nope. That's that kind of junk is what colors my impression of the whole thing. And I'm kind of with Chris on that. I've seen so much Yahoo-ness that sometimes I just kind of snicker at the whole thing, I have to admit. Although there's such a need for it. I mean, I've called special teams. I've called for confined space. I've called for hazmat. I've called for a couple of things. And that's just me doing my awareness thing. You know, I've been awareness trained as, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm going to back off.
You're absolutely right, Buck. I mean, I think, you know, we had a bridge rescue probably 6-7 years ago here, where a bridge worker was trapped when part of the scaffolding collapsed, and he was all the way at the top of this suspension bridge. And they, you know, we had a high angle rescue team, but there weren't any EMS providers on it. And it was we had to wait until a supervisor came in from the other end of the county, because the local team, the local EMS crew, wasn't really comfortable getting roped up and hauled up there to treat the patient. Well, because he was trapped. There was no way, easy way of getting him out.
Oh, bad.
So, I mean, you know, and it just points out in the need that, and actually we learned from that, and that's why there was planning to have a significant EMS presence when we put together a countywide hazmat team, was because of the lesson learned from that, was that we had providers that, for their own safety, were not comfortable being taken up there until somebody came in that had the proper training and background to do it safely.
Yeah. It needs to be done, but the other thing that I found in my area is now that the teams are kind of in the domain of the fire departments, they're almost so protective of them that they don't want to ever let them get to EMS again. And there's this political animosity now, and I think it's been more damaged than ever. And I think it's just set in stone that there won't be a paramedic doing that. I could be speaking in the wrong place, but I've heard some of the guys who are kind of high up in these teams talk, and they're not very friendly to the EMS folks. And that's just my area, though. And I need to stop applying my experience in my area to the rest of the country, because it just doesn't apply all the time.
But that's one of the problems with EMS in this country, is that there are so many different systems and models, and they all work well for certain things, and they're all miserable in other applications. And I think that that's just, you know, indicative of some of the root problems in EMS. And we keep coming back to this, but I think that that's just part of the problem we have.
A hospital-based system wouldn't even touch this with a 10-foot pole. A private system would be running the other way as fast as they could.
And well, you know, you might be surprised.
Well, you think Rural Metro or AMR is going to jump on a, you know, hazmat rescue? I mean, they wouldn't really. I mean, I've worked for both of them. I could be surprised. Now, I know Rural Metro actually has private fire. which is just a bizarre concept to me, but that is something they can do, yeah.
You know, sure, they protected for years the city of Scottsdale, Arizona. But the, you know, AMR in Portland, Oregon, maintains an organization called the RAT Team, which is the acronym stands for Reach and Treat. And they are very skilled mountain, ice, avalanche rescue dudes, because they're the primary service area. They're the primary providers of medical service on Mount Hood.
And if you're a government agency and you contract or put the contract out there that part of your contract to get the transport service for your community includes providing a tactical EMS team, you know what? The companies that come in and bid on it will find a tactical EMS team.
Absolutely.
I know
several very well respected hospital based tactical medic teams. One in York, Pennsylvania. That's a private, not even a governmental hospital, has been doing it for years, and the other one is the University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey, which they provide tactical medical support to the marshals and the FBI and all kind, and in addition to the local police departments. So you know, there's no one size fits all. They will or they won't.
There is none. But you know, I would like to know though, and this would bother me, and this is one of the reasons why in this region that would never happen, is are those same guys allowed to enter into the hazardous duty retirement of that state? And that would be a shame if they're not. And I don't know how other states run, but in Kentucky we have a hazardous duty retirement system, and you're in 20 years and you're out, where other government employees have to get 27 under. But private services, and some of them are first response 911 services, but if you're private, you can't participate. Too bad. Even though you're working by government contract, you can't retire by government contract. And it's just a shame. And I'm wondering if the people who participate in those kind of systems have the same kind of disability insurance, the same kind of retirement, the same kind of benefits that the government employees get.
Well, and right? They don't.
The short answer is no.
Yeah.
That is my wife text messaging me. I'm sorry.
I need that ringtone.
All right. I'm sorry. I wanted to hear the answer to that one though.
I mean, the short answer is no. They don't. They, you know, you get your benefits from whatever your employer gives you.
And the long answer is, and you can look back at 9/11 for this, how many of the hospital-based ambulance services that were part of that response that have people that are dying from the related respiratory issues are not covered by the state settlement for the firefighters? And most of them are EMS providers. Well, yeah, it does, but most of them are EMS providers that were contracted by the city that were part of that response, and they are not covered, even though the city firefighters involved were all covered.
Yeah, that's the thing that bothers me the most. See, if I had a chance to participate in that program and I looked at the disability insurance and stuff, I would just walk away. I wouldn't do it. And I wonder if that colors who signs up for the team, you know? So I'm just saying. That's a protection thing. And employee advocacy is another big subject of mine that bothers me. So, but anyway, Chris, you were trying to wrap this up, I think. Is that what you were doing? Yeah. We don't have to do a spot, do we? Do we need to segue? Yeah.
Oh no.
Thank you.
awesome. I've taken a look at them, and you know, I think it's a service that's needed, and I'm excited that they're involved in the podcasting marketplace. I really am, because I think that this is that just shows how forward thinking they are, and you can bring that into your agency.
I'm here. I'm fine. So, you know, actually, some of the last commentary gave me an idea for another garage, which is, why EMS employees are ineffective as advocates for themselves.
Ooh.
Because you know, all those questions about whether EMS, why EMS isn't in the same high-risk retirement program that fire and law enforcement is there's one answer to that, and it's the effectiveness of their ability to advocate for themselves. We might want to ask Brendan to get Jamie Orsino, who's the Boston EMS union president, to come on and let us shred him for a while.
It's the man. It's the man, Skip. The man's keeping us down.
That's right. Yeah.
Well.
Go.
And try the free demo. Try it out right there. It's right there on the front of their page. Sign up and get the email sent to you right away. They're great. Yep.
Yeah, I think so. A less colorful version of what I've been told on several occasions is that EMS folks can't organize a sandwich in a kitchen. And although the actual presentation had something to do with a house of ill repute.
I gave that one out there. Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that, you know, Why does fire get the benefit that it does? Well, they've got a single group speaks for all firefighters. That's the IFF. The cops have maybe one or two. EMS is represented by everybody from the truck drivers to the janitors to the office workers to a bunch of independent associations that don't cooperate together, don't work together, and don't present a united front for the labor side of EMS. Hey, we the chiefs are not any better, but we're at least trying.
Yeah, and that's so telling. This is an EMS chief talking about this. So, you know, an EMS chief talking. Not that you're always at odds with employee advocacy, but it's pretty sad when an EMS chief kind of goes, you know, we're completely unopposed. I have seen unions that are actually toothless, cannot get anything done, and the stuff that they do almost seems even more harmful than the employees if it was been left alone, which is sad. So,
well, and I'll just chime in. I mean, in our county, the EMS chiefs are a subcommittee of the fire chiefs. And we meet before they do, and we have to come up with our two topics that we want to bring up to them that much, because that's all the time they have for us. I mean, literally.
Wow.
And we have to have our meeting done before their meeting starts, or we can't even present anything. I mean,
is EMS in your county in the fire service?
Well, I mean, it's yeah, because it's largely volunteer service. So the EMS is integrated in with every fire company. And so the fire chiefs committee gets together for their big dinner and they sit around and, you know, it's a good old boys network. And then the EMS chiefs have to come in with hat in hand and say, you know, we'd like to actually be able to start IVs. Can we buy some equipment? Well, I don't know. We're spending all this money. We got new Pierce fire trucks coming next month. You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, with this the Medicast is there every week. You can have it ready to download every Monday morning when you wake up. But this coming week, actually, I think you'll probably not get this podcast out in time, but the second Tuesday of the month during the fall, winter, and spring, we do the Medicast Live. And this Tuesday, we're going to be talking about hot products I saw at the EMS Today show in Baltimore and my picks for the two most innovative products of the year that I saw this year. And we're also going to, invite anybody else that wants to come on. Those shows can come on. Go to MedicCastLive.com, and you can actually listen to past episodes of the live show that I do once a month and call in live when next one comes around. Well, and anybody here on the panel, you know, feel free, 10 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow night, MedicCastLive.com will get you there. And it's easy to sign in and participate in the chat room, call in on the phone line.
Tomorrow I'm off to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and we'll be talking to them about the community paramedic program at their EMS conference on Thursday.
So nobody has lockjaw and loose jaw? Is that what it is?
Moose jaw.
Oh, moose jaw.
Moose jaw. It's about an hour northwest of Regina, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm here. But we got a couple things going on. Me and Greg are talking about going to the NAMC conference coming up towards the end of summer. He's speaking at it. I'm thinking about maybe doing an EMS Edgecast thing there because they're still accepting applications, but we're working up slowly to it. And I just want to give people a hint. I've been talking to Chris and some other folks, and Chris has very kindly given the green light to make some changes that are coming up. We're not going to ruin anything, but we're probably going to add some exciting new features to kind of the EMS Garage lineup of shows and how people will interact with us. And I just want to give people that kind of taste of some going up. And we have interns now, too. We have minions. And yes, we have looked at this talk show thing, and it may come to pass with interns answering the calls and doing stuff. So just a hint at things to come. But we're trying to organize that and redesign and do some things, and it will all be good. But we'd like some instant feedback, hopefully, from our fans. It's cool.
We aren't.
Whoa.
And Sam.
Oh. My ego thanks you. I am. I finished, and my grades ranged from, oh my gosh, that's awesome, to, well, at least you don't have to take the class again. So I'm done, which is good. I'm happy with that. And hey, now, I'm the DD for everyone.
No. Okay, here's a better hint. More beer.
Oh, I can always count on you guys. But I start... What? No, please no. I start my new job tomorrow, which is exciting. And other than that, it's just more rescue squad and working. Well, sure. Why not? I am a healthcare assistant at Planned Parenthood, so I'm actually an EMT there, taking vitals, giving immunizations, drawing blood, all that kind of fun stuff, which is really exciting because my dad's an OB-GYN, so I get to carry on my passion for women's healthcare in my new job.
Sounds like community paramedicine to me.
Yeah, really. Hey, look, at least I'll have eventually some insight to give on something. I feel really bad for not contributing at all tonight, but it was interesting to listen to.
Well, we're gonna watch some more hockey. And this week we are gearing up for our big cardiac arrest save celebration, which is a week from tonight. And for calendar year 2008, there are 59 folks who were dead when we found them, who walked out of the hospital neurologically intact.
Wow.
And we're having a big to do with them and their families and the medics and the firefighters and the telecommunicators and our elected officials, and a big shindig a week from Monday night. And then on Friday, I'm going to load up six of us, and we're going to drive up to Roanoke for the National EMS Memorial Service. And for those of you who are anywhere near the Commonwealth of Virginia, Sam, you probably ought to come up to Roanoke, because this is the last time the National EMS Memorial Service will be held within driving distance.
Wow.
It's moving out to Colorado next year.
Skip, don't you have something in gems this month too?
No, I had something in on the cover of EMS magazine this month.
Oh, my bad. I must have just...
Yeah, I had an article on career development in EMS, or other things medics could do for fun besides the back of the truck and the front of the truck, which was the cover story.
Well, we've been talking about tonight.
Yep.
So say, don't be shy. Plug yourself.
That's it. Cool.
Gala. Ah. That's cool.
What kind of an event is? What kind of an event is it, Chris? Cool. Is your television celebrity going to be the guy who does all the investigative reporting in Denver? Well, say hey to James for me, huh?
Ooh, let me plug next week. Tom Reynolds, who wrote Blood, Sweat, and Tea, is going to be on next week.
Great blog.
So,
great blog.
Yeah, he's going to be. Yeah, you can catch him in his blog, Tom Reynolds. He's at. He's on. I'm sorry, Twitter at Reynolds, and he's fun to listen to. Actually, I let him go right off my phone. I always enjoy what he has to say. But yes, he's written a new book called More Blood, Sweat, and Tea, and he's going to be. He's going to be on hanging out with us, and he's going to plug his new book. So everybody, look forward to that. Ha ha ha.